Well, what's today? It's the Super Bowl. Super Bowl week. The big event is tonight. And it's really become quite the national holiday. In fact, no one in their right mind plans something today directly in opposition to the Super Bowl if they really want many people to come. You know, there are parties galore. And there's no amount of chips and dip and alcohol to be consumed by well over 100 million people in the U.S. alone watching the game. Even overseas, and we saw this a dozen years or so ago or more, people are beginning to watch the Super Bowl in surprising numbers, even though most of them have no clue how American football works, and most of the time can't figure out why it's going one direction and not the other. Of course, there are commercials to watch, and to rate, and to laugh over, and to scorn. Do you know how much a 30-second commercial costs now? A cool $4 million for 30 seconds of your time. And of course, there's the halftime show, where we're still jaded by shocking wardrobe malfunctions from 15 years ago. And to be honest, general malfunctions about every year since. I think they planned them in just to shock us. The biggest unknown of the Super Bowl is how vulgar or how stupid or how impossible or how long the halftime show will be. I guess we'll find out in a few hours. Oh, did I mention a game? They actually play football at the Super Bowl. Sometimes we have all the parties and commercials and halftime shows that we forget that there are actually two teams playing. And this year for me presents a real conundrum. Permit me a little football talk here. I belong to the category of people this year who is still trying to figure out a way that both teams can lose. I know the Patriots may be the best franchise of all time and Tom Brady the best quarterback and Bill Belichick the best coach, but they've won enough. And it's somebody else's turn. I mean, come on. The Rams, on the other hand, let's face it, they should not be there. This is a bonus for them. You can try to persuade me for an hour that I'm wrong and talk about instant replay and referees, but when a call's bad, and when a Hall of Fame quarterback like Drew Brees ought to be there, I can't help but wish that the New Orleans Saints were there, not the Los Angeles Rams. Thank you for the amen. We're going to form a protest and go to Atlanta this afternoon. In the middle of all the press conferences and the personal stories, the past 2 weeks, not one but two, have been filled with practices for both of those teams. As if 24 weeks of preseason and season and postseason weren't enough to get them ready for the big game and this particular opponent. And I can imagine here on this Sunday, February 3rd, that players from both teams are ready to get on with it. You know, let's play. We practiced and we've played those preliminary games for long enough. You can only have so many final speeches, so many emotional appeals, so many tactical maneuvers and planning. At some point, the planning and the preparation has to end. At some point, you have to get out on the field and leave it all on the field. And in a few hours, that will be true for both teams. Your team, my team, at least one team that will win. There's a time to talk and there's a time to battle. And the time to battle for them is today. I can imagine that the Israelites felt that about 3,500 years ago. You know, God had given his charge to his leader Joshua. Joshua had instructed the people. God had spoken to them, and the people had pledged their allegiance and their loyalty to their leader, Joshua. And now it's Joshua chapter 2, and it's time to get on with it. It's time to move. It's a time for conquest. If we looked at Joshua chapter 1 as a kind of pep talk and a planning period, then chapter 2 is the pursuit of the promise, at least the launch of it. And chapter 2 is going to show in vivid ways one of the truths of chapter 1, that God will give his people the land of Canaan, the promised land. Even the mightiest enemies that are present against the Israelites will fall because of the power of Yahweh, God himself. And in our passage today, we're going to see that God plus any group of imperfect people or deficient leaders or difficult circumstances or all of it is a winning proposition. Because God's commitment to his own purposes and his own promises will prevail again and again. God can take any situation and he can make it succeed. Do you believe that? And given a choice, it only makes sense for us to choose to be on his side and to obey whatever he tells us as the ultimate coach, master, Lord. That's true throughout all of life. Turn in your Bibles, if you would, to Joshua chapter 2, one of the most fascinating, one of the most sensitive, one of the most encouraging chapters in all the Bible, and certainly in this book. And you should always bring a Bible here to Grace, because we believe in the power of the Scriptures, and we turn there. And in these longer passages, we won't be reading all of the verses, so for you to follow along and have something in your hand is highly important. We're going to follow this through this narrative, this story, by going rather rapidly through some phases, some points. The first one is this, that God's people encounter obstacles when they seek to follow God in obedience. Here at the beginning of Joshua 2, we find Joshua sending out two spies, which is rather ironic, rather reminiscent. As Yogi Berra said, it's deja vu all over again. Decades before, there were two other spies that went out, Joshua and Caleb, along with 10 others. They came back with a good report that 10 other spies did not. They turned out to be cowards because they didn't factor in that God plus them was a victorious proposition. So for 40 years, Joshua and his generation had to wander around before they could enter the promised land, while the generation of doubters and grumblers died off. And now again, they were ready. And this Israelite version of the special forces was sent to spy out the land. All two of them, two CIA agents from back then, the best that they had to offer. I can only imagine what Joshua was telling these two spies after having done it decades before. Spies were headed to Jericho. This lies between the Dead Sea and Jerusalem. And it guards a pretty strategic passageway. You can see they're coming in from the east, crossing the Jordan to take the Promised Land, which is on the left side there, or the west. It's kind of like if you want to conquer the Hudson Valley, you got to get New York City. If you want to conquer the Bay Area, you have to get San Francisco. Well, if you want to conquer here, you need to get Jericho. More on that in the weeks to come. The spies leave a place called Shittim, which has no particular value other than it's fun to say in church in English. It's a rather strange word in our Bibles. But that place had historical significance. It was there that the Israelites had rejected God beforehand, and they had prostituted themselves by sexually cavorting with Canaanite or Moabite women and the gods at the initiative of Balaam. You can find that in Numbers 25. This place had a sordid history before, and we hope that it won't happen again. Ironically, the spies get near Jericho, and they take up residence at the place of a prostitute named Rahab. Clearly, these two spies weren't all that concerned about other people judging appearances. And for them, following orders were more important than appeasing expectations. Still, staying at a prostitute's place was rather risky business. Yet the text, if you look here closely, avoids any suggestion that the spies and the lady Rahab had any sexual encounter. Rahab's house, her residence, was a kind of way station, a tavern, an inn. And if the spies had acted inappropriately, we would expect that some mention of that would have happened. After all, when Achan sinned a few chapters later in Joshua, we see that. There's nothing mentioned here that's somehow immoral in the Bible. Staying there simply enabled them to gather information and to figure out what military personnel were there and what opponents they would face. Somehow, though, the king of of Jericho got word of their presence. And the king wasn't pleased at all. Because whatever they were doing or not doing in Rahab's house, the urgent fact of the matter is that the king wanted to see them. He was nervous. He was angry. He wanted to know what they were doing, what they were planning, and how he could thwart whatever that was. There was a big problem for the king of Jericho. Now put yourselves in the spy's shoes here. Okay, they were trained in undercover tactics and secret initiatives, but something changes when you're there and all of a sudden your cover is blown. It's all fun and games until someone gets found out. And even those men, part of the CIA of the Hebrews, had to have thought, oh no, how's this ever going to succeed? There's a fat chance we get out of here alive. Put yourself in Rahab's shoes. She's running a brothel here, or at least was the main attraction. Prostitution is often called the world's oldest profession, and that may be true, but I would also call it the world's saddest profession. Because it devalues women. It creates an object out of a lady. It gives in to God-given desires pursued in immoral ways. Almost no self-respecting woman would enter this without coercion or abuse or some kind of pie-in-the-sky promise by some ill-meaning pimp. You know, prostitution's a tragedy, and it's all over our world. I've seen it up close in two places. One, about 15 years ago when I was in Thailand, I was on a lengthy mission trip with Encompass World Partners, and there in 2004, I saw the devastation of prostitution. Hundreds of men, mostly Western men, mostly European men, in the Thai capital, looking for love, looking for intimacy, and pursuing a sinful way to find it. And plenty of Asian men and some women who were taking advantage of young, teenage, 20-something Thai females to make it happen. It made my stomach sick. As I saw on the streets of Bangkok and of Pattaya, what was happening. Before that, I had seen a bit of prostitution up close on the streets of Berlin. Two main streets in that capital city, Oranienburger Straße, and what they call the Straße des 17. Junis, the June 17th street of historical significance. We were there, two little kids in tow, for our German-American club picnic. And we arrived there in June where the sun stays out long, and we were anticipating dozens and dozens of mostly German young people to come to join us there, which they did. But at 8 o'clock sharp, the street was lined with more than a dozen tall ladies with something else on their mind. Some of them German, most of them Russian. They all wore smiles, and it was all profoundly sad to me, because prostitution is a failure of humanity. And it's a scourge, a sinful one in every way. Rahab must have known that stigma, the pain of that herself. She was a used lady. She had a shameful occupation. She had no social standing, but she had another problem on top of that. And that was, she was hosting men who were there, not for the normal reasons, but to plan for her people's demise. And the king knew, and the king was hot with anger and on their trail, which added insult to injury. Things went from bad to worse for Rahab. We see the story develop beginning in verse 4. Humans tend to get creative when we try to overcome the obstacles that we face in life. Put this in the present tense because the carryover principles from here affect us today. Ahab had to respond here. She had to say something to the messengers from the king, so she devised her plan. Verse 4, verse 6, they tell us details. She hid the spies under stalks of flax, which was a crop used for making textiles. And research tells us that the flax had to be retted. It had to be laid out to dry, which meant soaking it and then drying it thoroughly. And there was a terrible smell with the soggy flax. It would be like, one writer said, putting yourself in a pile of pig slop.
So that's where the two spies had to lay underneath that.
But if your life's at risk, I suppose you'll do anything. The messengers arrived. Rahab was put under questioning, and her answer was not surprising, if a bit creative. She was, after all, thanks to her profession, very good at telling men what they wanted to hear, or at least making it believable. "Yes, the men came to me," she said, "but I did not know where they had come from. Verse 5, at dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, they left. I don't know which way they went. Go after them very quickly. You may catch up with them." Verse 7, so the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of the Jordan. And as soon as the pursuers had gone out, the gate was shut. Problem solved for Rahab and the spies, or so it seemed. She got creative when the obstacles came. Skip down to verse 12, where we see that humans want reassurance of our well-being. We want a confidence that we won't be abandoned. That was true of Rahab and the spies and us. That this apparent danger had passed since she sent them on a wild goose chase. And Rahab went back to the spies for a little heart-to-heart with them. We get the full confession, and we'll see that in a moment. But for right now, just look at the beginning of verse 8 and then verse 12. Verse 8, "I know that the Lord has given you this land." Rahab's not referring to some unknown abstract deity. She's saying, your God, Yahweh, the God of the Israelites, the God of your people, has shown himself to be powerful and capable here. He's going to give you our land. And if that's true, spies, then I need help. I need protection. I need provision. I and my family. She's desperate now, and she's pursuing a kind of clever thinking, a negotiation. She's seeking the art of the deal with these two spies to save her life. Verse 12. "Now then, please swear to me by the Lord," she says, "that you, spies, will show kindness to my family, you and your army, because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death." She had met a great need for the spies, and they were grateful, so they responded with relief. They responded with assurance to her. Kind of, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You save our lives, I'll save yours. Verse 14. "Our lives for your lives," the men assured her. "If you don't tell what we're doing, we'll treat you kindly and faithfully when the Lord gives us this land. Rahab, your reward is coming. You've been good to us." Keep going in verse 15, where we see that God has his hand on his people's lives, whether we're surprised by that or not. Let me say that again. God has his hand on his people's lives, whether we're surprised or not. Are you one of his people? Verse 15, so she let them down by a rope through the window, for the house she lived in was part of the city wall. It wasn't uncommon back then to have someone's dwelling place built into the city wall. The city wall was the defense mechanism for people back in those ancient days. And the fortification of that wall really mattered. And so people lived there. They were there to keep an eye out for intruders, attackers that were coming. And that included, apparently, Rahab. It makes you wonder if that was also a prime place for her, given her occupation, that she would be at the city wall where she could see outsiders. Rahab also had valuable information for them, geographical information. Verse 16, she said to them, "Go to the hills so that the pursuers will not find you. Hide yourselves there for 3 days till they return, and then go on your way." Now the men had said to her, previous conversation, "This oath you made us swear will not be binding on us unless, when we enter the land, you have tied this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and unless you have brought your father and mother, your brothers, and all your family into your house." They warn her, "If any of them go outside your house into the street, their blood will be on their own heads, and we will not be responsible. As for those who are in the house with you, their blood will be on our head if a hand is laid on them. But if you tell what we're doing, we'll be released from the oath you made us swear." "Agreed," she replied. "Let it be as you say." So she sent them away,
and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. Meaning she kept her promise. She affirmed that sign. The secret code worked and would work later. Verse 22, when they left, they went into the hills. The two spies stayed there 3 days until the pursuers had searched all along the road and returned without finding them. Then the two men started back. They went down out of the hills, forded the river, and came to Joshua, son of Nun, and told him everything that had happened. So now we reach the end of this story. In many ways, though, it's the start of the questions and the start of the meaning. Let's begin at the very end, verse 24, with the spies' conclusion, and then we'll look back at a couple of conundrums and a cause for joy for us today. Verse 24, God keeps his promises because he's committed to his glory. They said to Joshua, verse 24, the Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands. All the people are melting with fear because of us. So the spies come back, now not just with Joshua's words ringing in their ears, but with experience that God is with them. You know, it's one thing to get a promise, isn't it? Promises are a dime a dozen, unfortunately. It's another thing to experience the fulfillment of that promise. Some of you know that in your own lives. You have seen the hand of God at work. It's one thing for Joshua to tell the spies everything would be successful. It's another for them to see it with their very own eyes. Their faith had become sight. Divine guidance was now their reality. They saw that the Lord had given to them the whole country. It would be their possession. And God was causing before their very eyes the panic-stricken response of all the Canaanites. Had to have been great if you were a spy. And here in this little verse here, we read a phrase that we find not once, not twice, but three times in this passage, one of the keys to understanding it. Melting in fear. Look there. The hearts of the enemies were melting in fear at the prospect of the Israelites and their conquest to come here. Literally, it means to disintegrate. To disintegrate as if you're overwhelmed by a larger, stronger force. It's what happens when an ice cube is placed on the pavement with the hot sun down on it. It disintegrates. It melts. Referring to people several times in the Old Testament, it means to be utterly discouraged, to completely lose heart, to be full of dread. Their hearts are dissolved, they are seized with fear, and they have no courage. This was all predicted way back in the book of Exodus, that when God's hand was on his people and would lead them into the promised land, that the enemies would dissolve, disintegrate. They would be overcome. And here their hearts would be melting with fear. If God is for us, no one can be successfully against us. If God is for us, no one can be successfully against us. This report had to have been music to Joshua's ears. See, in the original reconnaissance, the original spying, back in Numbers 13 and 14, Joshua and Caleb, the 10 other spies had hearts that were melting with fear. Read that today. Numbers 13 at the end. But now it's the enemy's hearts that are melting with fear because of the reputation of Yahweh, the God of the Israelites. Joshua is tasting here the deliverance of God. And that's the big idea. That's the overarching takeaway of this passage in its context. God is faithful to his promises. God is powerful to secure his victories. God rewards his people as they trust him day by day. Don't miss that. But the text raises here a couple of very challenging questions about truth and about faith. And we're going to explore them in that sequence. First one about truth. What do we do with Rahab's lie? You might have caught that Rahab lied there. Clearly. The question isn't whether Rahab lied, but how we should assess it. And part of the challenge is increased because it worked. Her lie protected the spies and assured them of success. And to confound us even more in this particular passage here, we don't find any evaluation of the lie here. Good, bad? I mean, what are we supposed to think? What did God think? The passage just reports it, which is true of many passages in the Bible, especially the Old Testament. They are descriptions of what happened, not necessarily prescriptions of what ought to have happened or what we ought to do. The Bible's not just an answer book. It tells the stories, good, bad, and in between, of people who encountered God. Here, Rahab isn't censored for lying. She's not condemned for lying, so we ask ourselves the question, was she right? What are we supposed to think of this? People have wrestled with this conundrum for a long time, the so-called righteous lie. Is there a righteous lie? A couple of options here. One of them is that we can view this as the lesser of two evils, that it's an acceptable sin. Here, ethicists tell us there are two less than perfect options, and you got to choose one of them, even though it's technically sin. But God will overlook it if we repent. Sorry, God, you knew I had to, because we don't have better options. It's an acceptable sin. Second option is what they would call hierarchicalism. It's a lie, yes, but not sin. Two values or commands are in conflict. You got to choose one. Which is the greater good? And because you choose that, by definition, that choice is not sin, according to this idea. For instance, remember the story of Moses and of the Hebrew women who deceived, lied to Pharaoh and his court about the young boys so that the young Hebrew boys could be saved. They wouldn't be slaughtered. Or in our own day, or at least the last 100 years, you were a citizen over in Europe, a Jew came to you, begged for housing, you took them in. When the Nazis came, you said, "What Jews? I don't have any. Go somewhere else looking." To save life, you had to lie. Third option, non-conflicting absolutes. That a lie is always a sin, so don't, ever. There's a conflict, but God provides another way that you don't think or see possible so that you don't have to sin. In this case, don't lie and don't give away the presence of the spies. Trust that God will provide. Here's how it's even more complicated. In the New Testament, Rahab is praised not once but twice for helping the spies. But as we're going to see in a moment, those are carefully worded verses that don't commend her lie. They commend her help. All that to say, this dilemma of Rahab lying isn't easy, and it challenges our understandings and our experiences and our sense of justice and even our view of God. You won't be surprised to hear that we had some robust discussions as pastors this week as we looked at this passage. Done a lot of reading from some significant sources and trustworthy ones. There are legitimate arguments for multiple perspectives here. One of our pastors said, yeah, we can all relate to that favorite verse, 2 Habakkuk 4:4. Lying is an abomination to the Lord, but a very present help in time of need. That's actually not in the Bible, but many of us wish it were. Despite these complications and challenges, I would endorse option 3 here. Rahab lied, and it was wrong. Whatever she felt, she didn't have to and wasn't right to lie. And however much we would imagine doing the very same thing, we wouldn't have to, because lying's wrong, and it's condemned throughout the Bible. How do we know that? Proverbs 12:22, the Lord detests lying lips, but he delights in people who are trustworthy. Romans, New Testament, 3:8. Why not say, as some slanderously claim that we say, let's do evil that good may result? Their condemnation is just. In other words, the ends don't justify the means. One Old Testament scholar, I would affirm what he says, God allowed his purposes to be fulfilled in this most unusual manner because his grace can operate in spite of the sinful maneuverings of men and women. untruth, lying, cannot be vindicated simply because it's closely tied to the total result. Yeah, but what about her desire to protect human life? Isn't that temptation justifiable to indulge in? Well, here's what the Bible says. 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. God promises, in other words, deliverance for us. Or here's one about Jesus. Hebrews 4:15. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. In other words, Jesus faced all manner of temptations, including the opportunity to lie, to save others' lives, and to save his own life, but he didn't. Jesus never lied. And not only did he refuse deception, he entrusted himself, 1 Peter 2 tells us, to him who judges justly. God values the integrity of truth, and God values the sanctity of life. But even the protection of life is not the highest good, because if that were true, why would we have any Christian martyrs? Why would we be called to lay down our lives for others in need? And yet history shows us those who did, who instead of deception confessed their allegiance and lost their lives. Again, I would agree, in evaluating Rahab, we render a mixed verdict here. It is one that condemns her lie in a momentary lack of trust in God, but one that commends her faith both in deed and in word. In other words, God judged her ultimately by her enduring faith, not her lie. Which brings us back to the thrust of the passage, Rahab's example and the work of God. Second, final question, what do we do with Rahab's claims? Look at verse 9 through 11. There we see that God reveals himself to people so that they may trust in him. God reveals himself to people so that they may trust in him. Verse 9, she said to them, I know that the Lord has given you this land and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. There's that phrase again. We've heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. Verse 11, when we heard of it, our hearts melted in fear, and everyone's courage failed because of you, for the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. See, Rahab sees what happens here, what God has done, and she concludes that God is behind it. Not some abstract pie-in-the-sky God that she could never know, but the God of the Israelites, Yahweh, the one who was with these people. And because of that, her people's hearts are melting in fear. This is a God who has acted in history, the Red Sea, the battles with these kings. This is a God who is present in heaven above, and he's active in earth below with his people. This is a God who gives and controls life. These are the fascinating confessions of a pagan prostitute who sees the hand of God at work before her own eyes. She believed in one God, not the multitude of gods that populated all the heathen temples. She believed that this God is a personal God who's at work somehow, some way, in the lives and hearts of the people who trust him. She believes that he's not limited to one nation, one land, but that he is the God of heaven and earth. This pagan prostitute receives stunning commendation in the New Testament. In fact, she makes it into the hall of faith in Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews 11:31. By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. You know, there are only two ladies mentioned explicitly in that whole chapter, Hebrews 11. Sarah
Abraham's wife, and Rahab. Warren Wiersbe, a pastor in the late 20th century, wonderfully compares these two women. Sarah was a godly woman, the wife of the founder of the Hebrew race, and God used her dedicated body to bring Isaac into the world. Rahab was an ungodly Gentile who worshiped pagan gods and sold her body for money. Humanly speaking, Sarah and Rahab had nothing in common, but from a divine viewpoint, Sarah and Rahab shared the most important thing in life. What is it? They both had exercised saving faith in the true and living God. Rahab wasn't just a woman of faith, but a woman whose faith resulted in action, who gave evidence of her faith. Here's the other verse in the New Testament, James 2:25. James 2:25, we read in the same way, "Was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction?" Verse 26 says, "The body without the spirit is dead, so faith without deeds is dead." Her faith wasn't just an abstraction, just external. She had undergone a change of heart, a change of view. And she was now acknowledging that this God, the God of the Israelites, Yahweh, was the one true God. He alone was worthy of worship and allegiance. And so she cast her lot with that God, your God, the God. So the boundary now between Israel and Canaan wasn't drawn along ethnic lines, which group do you belong to, but allegiance lines to the Lord. Here's the bottom line. God will prevail. And God is looking for people then and now who will confess that he will prevail and will run to him, not from him, in time of need. Pastor Zach said it this week, "The knowledge of Yahweh melts hearts to realize that they have nowhere else to go for safety and deliverance, then and now." God will prevail. When God corners you, God reveals something about himself. He reveals that he's not some evil spiritual pimp looking to abuse you. He's not some tyrannical, wicked king. No, he's a loving, holy father. He wants your best, but you have to surrender to him in order to get your best. So stop fighting. Stop running. Stop hiding. Life teaches us that experience can be a very cruel master. Every one of us gets stuck on something in life that produces shame in our hearts, and we're paralyzed. Friends, this passage tells us that you are not defined by your past or by your reputation. The past is a place of reference. It's not a place of residence. The past is not meant to be where you live. It's meant in the power of God to be where you leave. Rahab learned that here. So can you and I. So should we. And you don't have to be a prostitute to learn this. Let me clearly say this as if what Rahab did wasn't enough. If you have deep, unknown, disreputable, prolonged sin in your past, you are not washed up for God. God calls you to confess it if you haven't, but then when you do, God graciously whispers to you, "Forgiven, forgiven." And he deals with it. He dealt with Rahab's sin, and he deals with your sin through a Savior. His name is Jesus Christ, the one who came to deal with our past, to cleanse us in the present, to use us for the future. God finds you valuable, and he finds you useful. Here's how I know that. Because there's a third reference to Rahab in the New Testament, and it may be the most powerful. Matthew 1:1 says,
This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Skip down to verse 5. Solomon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was who? Rahab. The father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse. Jesse, the father of King David. David, the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. That is Bathsheba. Four women named in Jesus' genealogy: Tamar, Ruth, Bathsheba, and Mary. All of them foreigners except for Mary, all of them with complicated pasts except for Mary, but all of them offered a future with God. God uses flawed people and self-serving choices to accomplish his purposes. He uses flawed people like you and me and self-serving choices like ours to accomplish his purposes. See if God can use a prostitute like Rahab to help bring about Jesus the Messiah. Don't you think he can use tainted, imperfect people like you and me? People like us, whatever our flaws, people like you, whatever your baggage, whatever your limitations. This story, friends, says your flaws aren't fatal. Because if Rahab is useful to God, then why not you? And if Rahab is willing, then why not us? God's waiting for our response.